Welcome, welcome, welcome. Text of the Matter is back in living color.
Yes, in person. We are here together, which is a rare treat.
It is a rare treat, and I'm glad we can make this happen.
Yeah, for sure.
Not only is it better for you and I, but I'm sure it's better for all you out there to actually have two people talking to each other instead of little computer boxes.
Yeah. Digital mediation.
Uh-huh. And we're talking a bit about mediation today. I think like this section of Capital is like probably one of the most important sections of the whole book. For me, it's one of the most exciting sections. Namely, we're talking about transformation of money into capital and of absolute surplus value and its creation. And really lays down the fundamental structure of why Marx's economic theory would be considered revolutionary. And I think adds a kind of philosophical vantage point that most economists don't have, that really do some interesting things to really identify how capitalists exploit labor and how they in turn use that to valorize their capital and create, the system that we're all stuck in right now.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And there's this moment that's just really funny, and we might not get to, but I wanted to mention it, where he's talking about like the ideals of the average vulgar economist, and he's talking about the space of circulation in the market as an ideal, and he lists it, it's like freedom, opportunity, or equality, and Bentham.
And Bentham, yeah, I was going to say.
And so with that, Bentham, the thinker of utilitarianism, who, if you are on the internet at all, has surprising weight in the group of people who call them like it's democratic socialists. You know?
Really?
Yeah, it's a strange thing.
Bentham, as our Foucault friends know of, as the sort of idea creator of the Panopticon, and
this person who was largely arguing that humans act for their own desires and for their own ends, and that structurally out of this like sort of pure freedom we can create a system of ideal laws, so forth and so on. The reason I bring this up is that, you know, what Marx does, and again to return to the revolutionary quality of it, is that while there is an element of morality to the theorizing on economy, he both removes this moral element as a question of like why humans do these certain things, and then transforms that discussion and moves that discussion to a level of abstraction and totality and formalism that allows us to both better think about the whole, but then also address materialist concerns, like the actual things that go into these forms, the objects that are part of them, the structures of people that are part of them, that are part of them.
You know, the like constituent components of the economic system, and in removing this kind of moralizing, this morality, this ethics even, you can actually see, I think, what Marx does. He is able to identify the processes by which they work much more accurately.
Yes.
And, you know, I think most people think of Marx as, you know, in the context of revolution and his work with the Paris Commune and kind of starting what we think of communism today.
Exactly what we talked about in the last episode on the Communist Manifesto.
Right. But I think this isn't the Communist Manifesto. You know, this isn't a call to arms, workers' call to arms or something. This is an economic manuscript on how this works.
Are you a communist because you read Karl Marx? No. You read Karl Marx because you know you are a communist.
By removing this stuff, what you start to see is the actual processes of how things work. And so one of the first things he identifies is that we talked about in our last episode on Capital, that in traditional economics, the sort of exchange form is commodity for money, for commodity. Things are centered around their use values. That, you know, if you're purchasing bananas, it is because you are making banana bread. He's identifying in the capitalist tendency that comes out of this historical feature of mercantilism and the sort of rise of the bourgeois class in Europe, is that what is starting to happen is the exchange is flipped. And really, it's money, you have money, and you're buying a commodity, not for its use value, but then to bring it back to market and sell it. And so the fundamental idea has been switched. And from this observation, he goes on to really identify the core of the capitalist heart.
Well, and in his observation of this, like, basic form, what he calls CMC and MCM, yes, right? He is identifying a blind spot in the way that capitalists generally interpret their own activity, right?
Yes.
So for them, it is a relationship of buyers and seller. You're coming from the perspective of a buyer, you're coming from the perspective of a seller, right? And this is in constant circulation. One person buys, one person sells, one person buys, one person sells. And when asked what begins this process of circulation, the buyer says it's the purchase and the seller says it's the sale, right? But for him, he says that this creates an internal, an intrinsic equality, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That ultimately what is bought and sold is for the same amount. The one person goes to buy corn, the other person goes to sell corn. The money that is exchanged is going to be equivalent to the labor that that person in this older, even pre-mercantilist, but even into mercantilism, there's always going to be a one-to-one relationship between what is bought and what is sold in terms of value, right?
Yes.
So there becomes a question, how then does capital arise out of the system? And he says, very interestingly, that while this structure of equality, you know, remains within circulation, within this simple and vulgar system that is described by people like Bentham, mm-hmm, and other, mm-hmm, economists of the time and ethicists, it is outside of circulation where these things are resolved, and then suddenly where surplus value, that which distinguishes the money form from simple equality, comes to arise.
Yeah, and I love this part of his thinking in this capacity, because what I think is really interesting and unique about his thought is he's identifying that nothing comes from nothing, right? And so if you're creating surplus value, where is it coming from? And he makes the leap, I think, much differently than other economists of his time, and saying this is not a game of, this is not an art, right? Like, this doesn't come down to, because he obviously observes that, yeah, like, sometimes you can buy low and sell high, right? Like, that is something that happens in all forms of exchange. But in its totality, he observes that, like, at the end of the day, on average, all of this exchange is equal. Or is going to be very close to equal. And that is not how valorization happens. It's not by being an astute businessman, but that there must be some additional function that is creating value from somewhere else. Because it's not like capitalism or capitalists, and yeah, some go bust, right? Some go broke, some are very successful. But looked at as a totality, all capitalists are all making money. And yes, some do go broke or something, but on the whole, there is value being created in this system that is outside of just mere speculation.
Yeah, so exactly. So to put that in other words, you know, there is this sense, and you can even hear it today, that it's sort of out of the product itself. Oh, that's a good product, that's a bad product. That person made a good deal or a bad, mm-hmm, deal, right? This is where surplus is created, and that is what he's absolutely denying. He rather finds a completely different mechanism, a different commodity, one that is new historically,
yes,
that transforms the way that money works, you know, en masse. He doesn't get to, at this point, how it arises out of a non-capitalist system, but he does observe this new tendency, and that is what we all know as labor.
Right, 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 as so, labor. And so this kind of conception also comes out of, you know, we talked about this in our previous episode on Capital, but this idea of like a socially constructed value of labor. And I think this is really important because what he starts to say is there is a socially determined value for someone's day. And it's, we'll just call it X amount of dollars. It doesn't matter how much money it is or it is not. But socially accepted, there's a certain expectation that because we are no longer producing goods and selling them at the market, that instead the commodity in which we are selling is our labor time, that, you know, essentially we are selling this product that is a malleable commodity. And out of this creates a system that sides with the capitalist.
Yes, we must subsist. Yes. We must live.
Yes, right? Thank you. I got a little detracted there. Yeah,
no, no.
It's like all, but it's surrounded on the idea that a day's work will accomplish subsistence for a day. That there is an equal exchange there.
Exactly. So suddenly people are not simply going to the farm and working to create vegetables that they will both consume, but then have some surplus of, which they will trade directly for another object of use value, right? Instead, we live within these new environs that are themselves transformed by labor, which that themselves predicate our labor and determine how we labor, new machines, roads, etc., which create all of these new relations. And out of that, this new person arises, this person who must subsist and must get whatever they need to do that subsisting, be it clothing, which, and an interesting thing that you notice is that this new form of subsistence is itself a variable thing determined by geography, determined by cultural and historical conditions, right? So suddenly you have a person who is going to market and they're not producing anything themselves. All they have is their ability to sell their time and the use of that time for some end. And that new market becomes the space of the capitalist. The capitalist must buy an accrual of labor, of people using that specific amount of time that on average creates a basic level of subsistence, which Marx calls their labor power.
Yes.
So labor power, you know, strictly defined, is the average amount of time that it takes for a person to subsist, being put to market and then being accessed by the capitalist in the abstract, right? And you mentioned another word earlier, which is valorization, right? So there is this interesting relationship, and also kind of the first concept of alienation, which we referred to earlier, which develops here.
Which is the idea that we are selling something which is actually integral to our human, to our person, our self, and that we are maybe not in the sense you would think of like in like a Radiohead alienation, but in the sense that we are alienating our labor power, we are selling that as a commodity to the capitalist. And one of the important distinctions he makes there is we are also selling our labor power in advance.
Yes.
So, you know, we all know this because we all have jobs and we all work. When I make an agreement with my employer and say, you're going to pay me X amount of dollars for X amount of time, they don't put the money on the table and then I walk away and then I do my work. But rather, I have to make good upon my commodity before I see the money for it. And so this is important because, you know, one of the things it namely does is it keeps you then dependent on this system.
he essentially defines two basic preconditions of labor in general,
right.
That it, how it becomes labor power at all. And those two preconditions are, one, that it is temporally determined, right? That is, that it is organized into work days, work hours, salaries, various other contracts. This is different than, you know, a rural peasant, right, who is living in the feudal era, right, who, you know, does some work and then has some kind of like very specious relationship to their lord and may get some things or may get some money,
right,
and maybe
right.
doesn't get anything at all. Now we have these contractual relationships where, in general, there is a crystallized, as you would call it, form in which that labor and time takes. And by allowing that to market, it gives the capitalist the opportunity to do things at a scale and with a scope that had otherwise not been possible. And so for the second precondition is simply that you actually have to not just imagine or like you actually have to freely work and realize the potential of that time, right? So not only is there this average of time that a person must go to and work every day, but they must, you must create this form of repetition in life,
right?
Where I work one day, 2 days of this new contractual obligation, and that I repeatedly create the transformation of an object. Say you're a worker. He uses the idea of spinning.
Yarn,
right? So say you are now one of these new laborers that is going to a factory of some sort that is spinning yarn. You are able to go for the whole year that your contract is, or for the whole month that your contract is, and spin yarn every day to an average degree that will both create subsistence but also create something for the capitalist.
Right.
The product.
And this, I think, is an important distinction because, you know, this isn't, again, like a sort of maybe a more historical form of production where, you know, the sort of contract is more based around what you are producing, where this is, you are selling your time. And so all of a sudden, the way that the capitalist looks at your time as a worker changes, right? So like, I'll just use a random example, like making beer, right? Like, as opposed to being like, okay, we expect you to make X amount of beer, it is, we expect you to make X amount of hours. So in the earlier system where it might be like, so in the process of making beer, it's like a lot of food where there are certain points of the process where it's like, well, you're just, it's got to, you got to boil the mash for 60 minutes. So like in that hour, you're not laboring much, right? You really, the real labor is being done by the boiling water. But now in this new capitalist system, time is money.
Yes.
And so we now have an engagement where I need to be perpetually busy to make the capitalist money.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I am working and not stagnant, is the capitalist and the factory and the business is being more productive.
And this is kind of a fascinating element about Marx's observation, which is that on the one hand, you have exactly what you're talking about. There may be the point, that hour of work,
right,
is this specific point at which there might be the realization of, from the capitalist perspective, the most value, right? But that is actually largely irrelevant, right? You could say in the creation of a computer, right? If someone is producing computers, there's all these different points where they're creating all these precious metals and circuit boards, etc. Sure. And then there's a point where someone puts together the actual commodified object of the computer, and that gets sent out to be sold. and various forms of specialization are all part of the different ways in which that labor power is applied to this totality of time. And that forms one side. And this is a dialectic that is operating within the concept of labor and labor power. So there's that on one hand. But then on the other hand, this labor time is generalized. It is turned into an abstract whole that includes all these varied relationships between special forms of labor, the materials that they use. And he creates various classifications. So, for instance, one could work, there's in various forms of extractive labor. You could be a fisherman, you could be a miner, etc. But that's not the majority of industry. The vast majority of industry works with what he calls raw materials, which take that iron ore or take those precious metals, for instance, in the computer, and prepare it to be used to make some other product. But again, this returns to this very simple form, the way the capitalist imagines it, that the act will immediately produce a product that goes out to market to be used, you know, out there in the world for some abstract sense of subsistence. But in this case, in the case of labor power and the sort of assemblages of human activity and products, there is a constellation that ranges from the person to the transformed material, to the material then being used for a specific thing, and then that thing being related to another machine that may speed up that process, etc. And so this totality forms two sides. On the one hand, a qualitative, subjective element that is labor power, and then on the other, to return to that word valorization, the actual totality of time, which could be, even though it may take 6 hours, as Marx says, for subsistence to be met, the amount that one must work for the capitalist to survive per day, but instead, the capitalist may buy 12 hours of time, right? Doubling the amount, and may combine your labor with machines that make it more efficient to produce something that would formerly take someone 6 hours to do may come to take 1 hour to do. So then you multiply by six each hour. That is the difference between valorized labor, which clearly has a relationship with fetish, as we talked about in our first episode, and just the abstraction of labor power. The capitalist valorized labor power is a real concrete use of all people's materials, activities on the earth to actually transform it, use it, and produce surplus.
Yes. And so this is probably a great time to talk, because what Marx does is he talks about like how value of a commodity or a product is created. And it's not just okay, this has a use value, and so I'm willing to pay X amount of dollars for it. But there's actually, in this whole process that you're talking about, all of this is adding steps to the value of a commodity. So, you know, in his example, you were talking about spinning and creating yarn. Or, you know, you can take that further and say using that yarn to make a coat or something. But the idea is, you know, each step of the process is adding value, because every material, every raw good that you buy has a value because people have put time in creating it. And so you have to, it has to at least be that much, worth that much as how much money it went into making it. But then there's additional cost, right? Your operating capital. So he talks about the machines that you use to spin the yarn, and those have a certain value that have to be accounted in the totality of selling this over years, right? You have to make back the money you spent to buy this machine. You also have to replace the spindles that inevitably wear out during the day's work or a week's work. And so all of these little pieces come to make up the value of a commodity. And, you know, this is like a very simplified thing. And I think a lot of people out there are like, yeah, no shit. Like,
but like the idea of slippage, right? That is something that does not exist at this point. But he is describing exactly that economic principle, mm-hmm, these ideas, mm-hmm, of efficiency, right? These are things that are only starting to be talked about with thinkers like Ricardo and Smith. You know, like, it may seem simple, but he is laying out these sort of operating mechanisms that will become assumed even in capitalist discourse, because that's ultimately what he's still describing, right, is capitalism itself and its function. But anyway.
Right. And so the reason that this is important, though, is because it leads to this sort of identification by Marx of the different kinds of capital, that there is a what he calls constant capital, which is your tools, your materials. These have a constant value. And this value, of course, is determined by the socially necessary time in its creation. So there's an understanding of, well, 10 pounds of cotton have about this value because that's how much it takes to pay someone to, you know, produce the raw material, which we know as cotton. Or in the spinning process, you need this certain machine that costs certain amount of dollars. And as anyone who's studied business know, as a business person, you slowly depreciate that machine, and in doing so are incorporating its eventual breakdown into the cost of each spool of yarn that you sell, right? Like, one spool of yarn is not paying for the entire machine, but over a 10-year period, it is, right? And so what Marx is noticing is these have constant values, and the values that the individual pieces have give a constant value to the commodity you're creating, right? So, you know, you're obviously not going to sell your yarn for less than the cotton you use to create it.
Yes, this is the equivalency that it's, you know, it still remains to some degree. So the question becomes then, how does a surplus arise out of this?
Right. And the common misconception, of course, usually is that somehow better technology or these kind of capital instruments are what's creating the surplus value. But Marx is saying, no, 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 that is wrong. Because even if you develop a new technology, it all of a sudden becomes the socially necessary
precondition for that product.
Right. And so at the end of the day, maybe it takes a year to normalize for markets to adjust, but that there is no value created in that discovery or in that advancement. And which leads Marx to say that, well, there is a variable capital, and that is labor power.
Yes.
What about labor makes it, in the eyes of a capitalist, this variable capital?
Yes. So, you know, that's a good question. There is a sort of constancy in the entire labor process that is all tied to a system of related use values. And those related use values are what create the equivalency that makes it so that, you know, you go in, you have the cotton or whatever that it is, the to produce the yarn,
right,
et cetera.
Right.
And then you have a certain amount of labor power. And then eventually you produce the product. Let's say it's the coat at the end. And that is equivalent to what is put in, right? And in all of this time, there is the one side of labor, this kind of subjective side of labor, where the capitalist is relating to specific laborers in specific relations to specific materials, right? But then from the more general and quantitative side, the capitalist begins to observe that he can, and we shouldn't say he, they can recognize the average value of this totality, right? And this reveals what Marx calls the twofold character, right, of labor, right? So here's a quote from a section on this. And so before I read it, he says that this is something that's historically determined, right? That it is only after this kind of accrual of technologies and of historical preconditions, like the mercantilist market, like new industrial machines, like roads that connect people and so on, right? But he says, by the simple addition of a certain quantity of labor, new value is added, right? So you have all your machines and everything, you add the labor to it, now you have new value, you're producing something new. But at the same time, there are already these old values that are retained in it. And by the quality of this added labor, the original values of the means of production, those are the old values, the whole entire system in which this new labor of the person acting out on the earth, start to produce this new value. This twofold effect resulting from the twofold character of labor appears quite plainly in numerous phenomena.
Which is, and so he's getting at this idea, and we've sort of been talking about it, but all of the means of production, whether they be raw materials, whether they be, the tools used to produce these raw materials, are adding value to your new commodity. But what really is the catalyst in allowing this old value to be retained by your commodity is the addition of labor, right?
Yes.
Like if you have a spinning machine, but no one to run the spinning machine, no new value is created. And so what Marx is starting to get at here is that there is a kind of objectification of our labor that is happening. So in us, and I'll use some fanciful language here, right? But in us livening this machine, making it, it's alive, making it run, making it produce, there is a kind of alchemy in there that adds worth, adds money value to your new commodity, right? Like you're going to pay more for linen sheets than you are the linen it's made out of, right? It is like a really rudimentary example. And so he's kind of getting at this interesting concept where for most of us, the way we interact with the market is we're seeking use values, right? We want a couch to sit on. We want microphones to talk into. We want food to eat. Whereas the traditional way we look at capitalists are they are producing goods to sell. They are less concerned about whether it's an umbrella or a pickup truck, but more interested in what those exchange values are that they can get on the market.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
Oh, and I was just going to add, this is the one instance where this is reversed, where the laborer, in selling their labor power, is actually interested more in its exchange value, and the capitalist is interested in the use value of my labor. And there's a kind of capturing that goes on in this exchange where the capitalist is capturing our use value and adding it to the value of its product.
Yes. And as that, and then it goes into a second transition, which is that then as that labor is taken into the totality of productive relations, into the means of production, it then creates a product whose qualities are disengaged from the things that produce them, from the person, from the person's intentions and actual ideas, for one, but also from, you use a dye to create a color. The color is then abstracted from the dye.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting that red towel or that red jacket or that red sheet, right? That becomes something that is exchangeable, right? Suddenly now the use value that was taken from the worker who is trying to exchange their labor then again becomes a new form of exchange, but completely unlike the actual product that was part of the means of production. So this is the dialectical shift into subjectivity through objectivity and back out into the subjective sphere, both entering into circulation and then exiting out of circulation into consumption. But one thing that is centrally important to Marx is that there that it is not simply the consumption of products that we imagine as outside of the human being. The capitalist is creating the possibility of consumption of labor itself.
Yes.
Right? The valorization and therefore actualization of labor, the full working day, the full time and system of creating products as means of production is this new abstraction for the capitalist.
Yeah, and this is where, because you might be sitting there and being like, okay, this is sort of confusing, but like, how is this any different than the constant capital, than the tools which the worker uses to create whatever the fuck product, or the raw goods that inevitably combine together or are worked upon to create something else. And this is what we're now getting to, in that the variable quality of the labor sold is that the capitalist sort of has the upper hand in determining what is the socially agreed upon value of said labor. And because as the laborer, we are advancing our commodity before we get the money that that we use to buy our subsistence from the very capitalists that we sell our labor to, mind you, that a variable is created. So instead of like the example we were using before, you're spinning yarn and you have to replace spindles, like one spindle every week or something. And so in the price of that yarn is, you know, features the cost of replacing those spindles. This value is added, but in a constant way. You know, and sure, a capitalist might add a 50 cents to it or something, but that's not how the capitalist is making their money, right? So where is this value coming from? And it comes from this dual quality of labor, in that, you know, much like the dual quality of everything in the economic sphere, our labor is adding value to the commodity that's being created, but it's adding value in such a way that is not just the wage that I'm being paid. I'm in fact adding more value to the commodity than I am receiving back.
Exactly.
And like a great, like a, the obvious example is this. I'm sure everyone's seen the meme, but there's like a meme going on right now where it's like a guy's like, for every hour I work, I can buy three of these little like viewfinder rubber pieces for a camera, and that, you know, the actual cost of making them, you know, he should be able to buy like 30,000 of them.
Yes.
I can't remember what the numbers are, but that these are being sold for a much higher price than what it takes to actually make them. And so, of course, the question is, how does the capitalist get away with this? How is this? Because in the traditional system of economics, things acquire value because of the labor put into them.
Mm-hmm.
And we are starting to see a split. And where is this split coming from? And it comes down to what Marx refers to as the working day, but that there is a variable value added versus from our labor time versus what we are being compensated for that same labor time.
Marx says something quite interesting, which is that we should essentially conceive, when we're thinking about how the capitalist accumulates and how capital is therefore created out of that accumulation and surplus, we should think of the means of production, labor power as it is abstractly, as almost a degree zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
To kind of return to something that was also in Kant. But that there is a level at which this average is always going to be, that it's going to be socially determined and internal to the structure of a society. And once we do that, then it becomes far more clear what it is that is the kind of additive element, what is the surplus element that comes out of all of the work, right? So once you remove all of these ideas, this complex, which really is the true material of the work.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Then you start to see that there, while he talks in very small numbers, because you know, we must note that at this historical moment, despite there being like the ability to sell things for profit, there was no imagination of the degree to which one could maximize the profit of an object like they have now, right?
Exactly.
You know, he uses this kind of interesting example of iron ore, the production of iron ore, it producing all of these fillings, iron fillings, that's waste. The waste coming back and being reused by the worker, right? To maximize the value that will then be exchanged for the capitalist, right? But that from the side of the laborer, they're just using a new material, a new form of the same old material, an old commodity, to create new value, right? But they get to see none of that. Whereas for the capitalist takes, oh, well, I turn this waste into a new material to produce, and I acquire X amount of surplus value that I can shave off for myself. In the case of the viewfinders, if with the ore, they might have made an extra 50 shillings, 500 shillings, whatever. Now, it's a multiplication of many times. But the principle doesn't change.
Right, right.
This is only a matter of intensity.
Right. And so, you know, again, to belabor this point, and I like that you brought up this idea of this zero point, because with the way that Marx starts breaking down like a company's ledger sheet is the capital materials, these constant materials, whether they be tools, whether they be the raw materials to produce the viewfinder shields or, you know, whatever it is, can almost always just be zero. Like, it doesn't matter if it's $100, $500, 50 cents. At the end of the day, those raw goods, their value is being transferred to the product. So they are being paid for by the sale of the product, always, in a way where they cancel each other out on your ledger sheet. And this is how he's able to identify that the surplus value is not coming from the new machine, as the capitalist would have you believe, or, you know, in some kind of fluctuation, smart maneuvering of the market. But that actually this surplus value, the what we would consider profit, is coming from value being added from your labor force that is not being returned to them. And this is, I mean, it's funny. It's part of this book is funny in a way because, you know, us talking about it right now, you might be sitting on your couch or whatever and being like, yeah, no shit. Like, yeah. I live this every day. Mm-hmm. But it's important to read and understand this because it's important to see the philosophical moves he's making to A, identify this, but B, that all of our lives have been vastly influenced by this book and this thinking, because this is how we are getting to the point where folks can make memes about it. Because, I mean, even up until the like 20s and 50s, you would have capitalists arguing that this is wrong.
Yes.
And so I think it's an important thing to note how easy it probably is for most of you out there to see the, you know, the sort of truth that he's stumbling upon, mm-hmm, through this like immense research of manuscript, of economic manuscripts, and very much influenced by, you know, Engels' work in the economic conditions of the English working class, which is kind of where I think all of this really stems from, you know. And we see that, we'll see this later when we talk about the working day, but, you know, basically Engels's dad sends him to Manchester to learn how to run a capitalist business, and the thing that Engels learns is like, oh my god, they're destroying these people. Yeah. And like, the way that you make money as a capitalist is by destroying your workforce, essentially. But I'm kind of jumping the gun a little bit, yeah, so we'll get there. But
what is at the core of the way that surplus is produced is that both old value and new value become a singular relationship. They become a totality. And that by extracting new value from that old value, right? From the old machines, adding new labor value to it, right? That is what is creating the surplus, because you're getting an overlap, right? You say for one unit of the day, right, you have a certain degradation of spindles or whatever.
Right, and right.
And this creates a certain amount of loss, right? That is going to create an equivalency. You're going to have to deal with that and the total amount of labor. That's going to be your total cost, and that's, you know, what you're generally going to get back. But when you apply extra labor to it, more labor to it, and spread that across a consistent level of labor for 12 hours, suddenly there is a difference between the amount of money that you would gain. I gotta find the quote for it again. I'm getting too far. Sorry.
While you find that, I want to say, you know, and this is why the point you made about the ignots is important, mm-hmm. right? And this is kind of what Marx is getting at, because at one period of time, say you were making iron dildos. And so you're able to make X amount of iron dildos with X amount of iron ore. You know, in a more simple exchange value where you are making these dildos and then selling them, you being like, okay, a certain amount of waste is created in this process, and I'm going to melt down that waste so I can use that ore to make more dildos. And in that circumstance, I would be making more profit when I went and sold those dildos in market.
Yes. Exactly.
But now, because I am not in the business of selling dildos, I am in the business of selling my labor time. When I do that and take that scrap ore and use that to make more dildos than I could if I didn't do that, the capitalist is now making that extra money.
Exactly.
And Marx isn't saying that this is how surplus value is created, but it is the beginning of how surplus value is created, because I am no longer receiving the proper exchange for my labor. Whereas at one point, those extra dildos would be extra money in my pocket. My labor time is now being subsumed into this totality in such a yeah. way where I am still going to make the same agreed upon wage than whatever my productivity may lead you to believe I should yes. be making.
And so this is, and this returns us again to valorization, which is what it means for you to go to market with your labor value, to be willing to sell it for a specific set of time, and for the capitalist to create an assemblage out of all of their materials and all of the different sets of time that they can get to maximize that production, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to create the maximum amount, the most efficient arrangement to produce those iron dildos, right? And, you know, it's interesting because, like, you can see that, you know, Marx has entirely understood the industrial age. Like, he's entirely, like, grasped what would come to pass within industry. So to get into more of a speculative mode, what I'm most interested about are two things. One is what happens when there is a sale of ideas, right?
Okay.
Right. So
much like we're doing, you can you know,
support us on Patreon and buy our ideas, which we are stealing from Karl Marx.
Yes.
No, I'm joking. Anyway.
But, you know, like, we have all of our material costs, etc. That's one thing, right? And we're, in some sense, yes, we are selling ideas, right? But even more so, let's say the person who produces an algorithm, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And that algorithm no longer has a system of degradation. It also no longer needs the human management in the same sense. It can start to produce itself. We can talk about AI, which we intend to do in another episode. But, you know, this is the first element, right? Like, there's a great moment in here where Marx, he's talking about, like, if someone wants to use a gold spool.
Right, right.
That's, you know, that's the capitalist problem. That's not part of, like, what he's actually talking about. But on the other side, he is talking about everything necessarily needing to be materially determined. So there's that, and then there's also the question of repetition, that work needs to be repeated to extract this value. But it's also presuming that the machine is going to function similarly to the human. It is going to degrade similarly to the human, right? And with the algorithm and with the sale of ideas, economic systems that are purely digital, and machinic systems where the degradation reaches time scales that are beyond human life, then suddenly we do have a shift in what we're talking about. And there's a, I think we've mentioned it before, but there's a note that Marx makes very late in life that once we reach a point where we are the overseer to mechanical processes that do not require human labor, the commodity form will change. Mm. He never expanded upon this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I think, what I've seen in this section, right, and in the same way that it is so clarifying about the age that we lived through and our parents lived through, etc., I'm also seeing in the way that he says there are sort of like these historical preconditions that determine what became capital, right, through the commodity and through money, that we're starting to see that in the commodity and money, the preconditions of maybe a change that, even if it isn't beyond capitalism, it is a new form of capitalism, right? It is a new form of capitalism that doesn't have these same demands on the human. It doesn't have the same demands on around technology and around the way that objects assemble to form what would be called means of production. And it adds a level of ideality and abstraction that isn't even accounted for in the way that surplus value here is created. Because once a person can, you know, like the person who is the house philosopher for Google, you know, sells their, it's essentially selling right. their presence to this corporation. That's something that is, and which can be done at an industrial scale as people go around, Tony Robbins and other people go around doing this or whatever. Like, there are these, all these new forms of commodity production that are changing very fundamentally, like, the way that people will have to think about how they sell their labor in the future,
mm-hmm.
right? As everybody tries to brand themselves and turn themselves into some digital form.
Well, right, and this is the fascinating thing, and it also proves Marx's point,
exactly.
right? Like, I don't know why we keep talking about beer, but many years ago I went to, what's the fucking bike beer from Colorado?
No idea.
Know what
don't
I'm talking
beer.
About? Oh, yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Some of you out there knows, put it in the comments. But I went to their brewery. It was a great brewery tour. They gave you 6 free beers. I was literally drunk face hammered when I left. But one of the interesting things in their production line, especially in their bottling line, but even certain parts of the like brewing process were so automated. So you've got this big warehouse fucking bottling thousands, millions of beers with fucking 3 guys working there.
Mm-hmm.
3 people. And you might be like, okay, this is crazy, and this or whatever kind of emotional response you might have. Fat Tire. They're called Fat Tire. But for Fat Tire, and maybe that's not even the brewery name, maybe that's just the beer name. But for Fat Tire, this is great because they had to invest, you know, we'll say $1 million into this machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that $1 million gets parceled out between 1 million beers. So maybe their beers like a dollar, like we'll say 10 million beers, right?
Yeah.
It's like
And they're sold ten, for $2 a piece.
Yeah, 10 cents more a beer. You never notice it. But
the labor cost.
But on the other side, they've actually cut their labor force, we'll just say, by 20 people, which all of a sudden probably brings their beer down to cheaper than it was before. But of course, they're not going to make it cheaper than it was before, and so they're maximizing their profits. And this is the idea that Marx is reaching upon, that in the capitalist system, by buying labor time, you have a much more controlled system of creating surplus value, because you have the control over what that value is worth, what that socially acceptable exchange rate for labor time. And because it's homogenized between high skill and low skill labor, that medium becomes much less than it would be if we were looking at things sort of fragmentarily and not as a totality. And so I think it's great that you bring up this idea of like an algorithm that doesn't degrade, right? Because it is actually making those sort of constant capital costs zero, which is what Marx suggests that you might as well just do. Because it's like, all right, say you want to make yarn with a gold spindle. Well, your yarn is just going to be that much more expensive for what, however much the gold spindle is.
Yes.
But you're not making any more money.
Yes.
Because those material costs get transferred, yes, into your product, but in an even exchange, where labor is the thing that is not being exchanged evenly. And the longer that this happens, the more exploitative these processes can be.
Yes, and ultimately that's the way that the algorithm is functionally used.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at the market, right, the algorithm is trying to constantly maximize in varying wider scopes and larger degrees of abstraction the way to maximize the surplus that one gets from a business, right? The best way, the perfect moment to buy the stock and to sell the stock. The perfect aggregation of people and objects to produce at maximum yield for lowest cost, right? And really, the only way that this could be changed is if the algorithm itself were deciding based on a different logic, which is a conversation for another time.
Yes, but I think a great example like that is like the healthcare system we have in this country versus a universal healthcare system in, say, a better country. I don't know. Pick one. But the
any number of Nordic countries, Japan,
right.
Cuba, you know, whatever.
But the arithmetic behind those decisions are different, because the state-run universal healthcare system, the decisions are being made to increase public health and not to create surplus value.
Exactly.
Where the capitalist system, it being centered around this idea of surplus value creation, its unintentional and subconscious motivation then becomes what Marx calls small theft. How do you squeeze more out of the labor time that you are paying for? Because that is how you increase your what Carl calls, I'm on first name terms with Carl now, what he calls the rate of surplus value creation. And he in talking about like the rate of surplus value creation makes this really important observation, where it's really easy to look at it in these small percentages, like what is your annual percentage growth of a business. And he's like, well, no, that's wrong. You are creating surplus value not as a function of profit, but by what is the rate of value you are producing off of the labor you are paying for.
Exactly.
So if his example is like, say it takes 6 hours at the socially determined wage rate for someone to make enough money to like have a house, buy their food, you know, buy their iron dildo. but you pay them that same amount for a 12-hour day.
Yes.
Your surplus value creation rate is not like 15% or whatever more money you're making per year, but you have doubled the amount of money you are extracting from your labor force, which is how surplus value is created in the first place.
And very quickly, just to go back to an earlier thing that he says when he's talking about the subjective side, the way that humans go to the labor market, he refers to it as having a moral element, right? That there is a why, there is a meaning, there is a life there when the human goes to market, because the subsistence actually has relation to the family. It has relation to, hunger, to things that will ultimately mean the difference between suffering and, yes, and surviving. Mm-hmm. Like, we must remember, and we talked about this some in our episode on the Communist Manifesto, but, there was immense, massive poverty in, I believe, Lyon at the time, 100,000 homeless children on the street, right? Like, from that subjective side, you are going to it with this moral demand that you can now try to find a means of living. But from the capitalist side, it's irrelevant why the person's mm-hmm. coming, just as mm-hmm. irrelevant as it is on the other side what they are selling. Because it is all just a formal relationship, a way in which they can organize time and organize and assemble space so that they can create this difference on the ledger,
right?
Right, and that will ultimately continue to accumulate and to allow them to then repeat this process, to possess more means of production, and through more means of production add more labor, and through more labor create more surplus, and that on their side it never ends, while on our side, on the side of the worker, we are continually squeezed more and more.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too, because you see the like kinder, gentler machine gun capitalist man this day kind of expressed through that process, because Marx talks about the working conditions in he uses Engels' work to talk about the working conditions in a lot of English mercantile factories, these things, and how they're like making kids work 12-hour days, mm-hmm. like 5 days in a row, and is just talking about how they're just churning through people like a meat grinder. But of course, there's social kickback to this. Like, they, you know, they try and create laws, child labor laws.
At this time, they're beginning to try to create a 10-hour work week. Or work day.
I wish.
Well, much like we're trying to get a 4-day work week, they're trying to get a 10-hour average. But for them, it was 12 hours a day promised, 12 hours a day, 9 hours on Saturday, and they would only have to work 5 days a week. That's what they were fighting then, and that no one be hired under 18. Right.
And so you might look at it and be like, okay, well, we've advanced, right? Like, I mean, I guess we rescinded child labor laws quite recently.
You go to any farm and, you know, we're still fighting for that for various migrants.
But overall, you look at the system and you're like, okay, well, you know, it took 60 years in certain cases, but, you know, because I'm thinking of like the fight for the 8-hour workday. But so you think like, oh, well, we do have some of these things. We've mitigated it a bit. But, you know, and of course, Marx doesn't talk about this because he's writing in the 1860s. But what has capital done? Well, they're still extracting that money from us through now the industry of debt creation, right? Where it's like, okay, yeah, I don't have to work, a 60-hour work week or whatever, 12 hours a day for 60 hours. 12, that'd be 12 hours. Well, they were working 6 days. So we'll say, I don't have to work 72 hours a week anymore, but... And also because of the accumulation of goods and services, I still don't make enough money where now I have to incur debt to subsist.
Yes. And then on the other hand, to talk about the ways in which old forms, old products become part of the totality through which they extract this value. Once we all own a cell phone, suddenly now, for various forms of labor, the capitalist has access to you outside of what would be considered the workday, right?
Yes.
So now the workday itself becomes something, it finds a new abstraction, a new form, right? And this is the oddity of digitization. Though it obscures and transforms some of these things that he's talking about, the principles stay true.
Yes.
Right? There is still the exploitation, no matter how much you want to believe that, like, you may want to believe that Beeple's artwork is, like, removing all of the material concerns, right? There's still a whole bunch of computer systems with a million graphics cards running, consuming energy so that they can produce that value, that accumulated value, right? Even though it is randomly given out to some person.
Yeah,
right?
Dude, like, reading this and, like, reading the section on working day specifically, it was just like a knife to the fucking heart over and over again, because, like, he talks about this idea that in the capitalist's mind, surplus value is created through moments. And in Capital, he refers to, like, oh, well, you're supposed to start at 6 a.m., but we actually make you start at 5:55,
mm-hmm.
or like 5:45, or like my lunch is supposed to be 30 minutes long, but really it comes out to be like 25 minutes long. And that, yes. You know, the idea of surplus value is created by stealing these seemingly small or inconsequential moments, but that these moments add up. There's a hilarious quote in there about that, about, like, a worker working 5 extra minutes a day adds $1,000 to his pocket at the end of the year, yeah. or something like this. But it killed me, because in my current position, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll get an email at 8:30 at night, and maybe the request isn't that challenge. You know, maybe it takes me 5 minutes to do whatever it is that they're asking, plus the, like, 2-3 minutes to, like, send the emails back and forth. But it's this small theft that I am having my labor exploited and is adding value to the company, but taking away from me in these small moments. And then, of course, it also builds, again, this socially accepted concept of labor time, where the more that I do that, or the more that my coworkers do that, the more it is expected of me that,
yes.
no matter what it
because
is,
of these socially accepted
that
standards.
I am responding yes. at 9 p.m., at 10 p.m., at 10:30, at 5 in the morning. And yeah, it might not be an hour of work, but I'm still losing. I am still freely giving
yes.
my labor time for nothing.
Absolutely.
And this is how value is built. Or surplus value, excuse me.
And so, to return to, like, this question of, like, these new technological forms, and the way that they relate to the totality of crystallized means of production and the way that our labor relates to them. Soon, we're going to address a work by Hedo Sterl. It may be a couple episodes from now, but it's going to be within there with our next work on Capital. This becomes kind of the question about technology, because what's so clear through Marx's writing is that though we have this tendency to have the people fearful, just like they are of the immigrants, of the automation, it's the machine that's doing this to me, it's the machine that's devaluing my work. No, it's the way that the capitalist uses the machine, right? Ultimately, a cell phone could be, and all of the other digital networks could be, an incredible means of reducing the amount of labor that we need to do, right? Just like an airplane should be a way to reduce the amount of time that we are working, but ultimately it's sent millions, if not billions, of people on to longer work days,
yes.
work weeks, working on planes, going to different places that to expand capital, right? So what we need to ask ourselves, in addition to, like, simply transforming these basic concerns, is how can we use and start to address these new technologies as means of transforming those basic formal rules that seem to be so deeply entrenched and determined. We'll get some of that as we go on in Capital.
Yes.
But some of that is going to be required will be produced out of our speculation because, as you said, he's writing this in, you know, from the 1830s to the 1870s. That's or 1880s. That's when Marx is writing, right? Like, he can give us the beginning, but at some point we have to speculate out of this. We have to start using his ideas to create new tools, new ideas, something that may be separate from him. And and I think technology is a major point of concern for that.
And I think that, you know, that's a really important thing to bring up because, you know, in Karl Marx's time, this was the communard. This was, you know, so he was writing the Communist Manifesto. We talked about this in the last episode. During the winter of 1848, which saw upwards of 15 different variously successful and mostly unsuccessful worker revolutions all over Europe.
Yes.
And so the sort of mode of fighting for our exchange worth, you could say, was through those means. And
running out in the street, maybe, you know, working hand in hand with some arm of the military that was also pissed off about their working conditions. Shooting, cutting off heads,
right.
Know, getting in fights, going to jail, right? But that may not be the way at present that
right.
we can realize it. I mean, we're facing a state that has also used this accrual to create a system of weaponry and surveillance that is, you know, so beyond anything that existed during Marx's time.
Well, right. It's like, you know, these, these crazy people and who hoard their guns and all this stuff and whatever. I have leftist friends who are in gun clubs and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, I don't care how many AK-47s you have. The government has F-16s. They have nuclear bombs. Like, it's not a fight you're winning. But the point being is, like, what are these forms of resistance? What are new forms of resistance that we can use to fight for and win back some of this time and some and you know, if you want to look at it in an economic term and like our exchange value, right?
Yes.
And there's some like interesting ideas. There's a French philosopher, Frederick Gross, who has a book out, came out like a year or two ago called Disobey, but he's kind of advocating for this like kind of Bartleby the Scrivener thing where, mm-hmm. you know, the I'd prefer not to, these instead of small theft, it's like small sabotage,
yeah.
right? Where perhaps there are ways, but it comes down to, like, I mentioned this example of like getting an email at 8:30 at night. You know, I out of fear, I respond. But I could not respond, answer that in the morning, or, you know, make an outgoing email message that starts at, you know, we'll say 6 or 7 every day that says, I do not respond to emails between 7:30 p.m. and like 7:30 a.m. And so if you want to receive something from me, you're going to have to wait.
But for that to reach the level of the problem that Marx is outlining, is it cannot simply be a relation between a certain amount of laborers within their, you know, using their subjective labor power within a specific way. It must instead be a universal way in which the means of production are transformed by the way that people do labor power. So, like, if there's going to be something, you know, this is kind of like an anarchistic response, right? And is, you know, more akin to, like, the way that Bakunin would approach the problem. I think for us, the way that we're going to have to start imagining is, how is it that we can get everybody or to a percentage where it becomes socially determined to transform the way that they are, you know, thinking about their labor, right? And though it sounds distant, labor is something that everybody does. That is what is at bottom of why Marx is talking about it.
Yes.
It's something that we all have to do. And until we don't, which is possible, you know, there may be a time where it's, things are so automated, we just don't have to fucking work, and they can just give a shit. But they're not going to want to do that. So we are going to have to try to get closer and closer to that moment, because I think we're actually far closer technically, even though we aren't there socially.
Yes, right? Yes.
But anyway, we've been going for a while. This was a great deep dive for us into this very dense part of the book. Next time we're going to go more into the workday. We're going to go more into the idea of community and into that point that where Marx saw the ability for us to shift and change and produce new conditions. And we're also going to get into some historical elements in other episodes, into some of the ideas that we've been talking about today, and create some more cool episodes that you all will hopefully enjoy.
Yeah, so thanks for tuning in. This has been a Text of the Matter production, where this is loosely our episode 2 on Karl Marx's Capital. Stay tuned for, we've got a few more of these coming. And if you haven't watched the first one, you probably want to see that, because some of this might not make sense otherwise. But thanks for tuning in. I'm Egon.
I'm Isha.
And we're Text of the Matter. Check us out on, I don't know, Twitter. Support us on Patreon if you want. We've got nothing crazy, but, you know, we got stickers and things for anyone who supports us. And there it is. And thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Fuck yeah, that was good. It's so much easier when we're, like, sitting in the same room and I can look you in the eye. Yeah.